And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. You know, I made mention yesterday of the fact that I was having issues with Spectrum, which is owned by Charter Communications out of Stamford, Connecticut. I never did get a chance to talk to the president. He ran for my phone calls. And a CEO that won't talk to a customer isn't much of a CEO. And they insisted that I was too dumb to install a TV cable box myself, so they sent out a tech, even though I asked them not to. And finally, after 3 hours, because they didn't give him a working cable box, the one he brought was defective. Today, I discovered that whatever was done yesterday affected the cable service in my studio. And I said, well, I just got off the phone with him. And I'm still too dumb to replace the cable box. Now, they assured me that they were both separate entities. One wouldn't affect the other. But this is the identical issue that affected the one yesterday. But, you know, dumb old me, I can't be trusted to install a cable box. They're going to send out another tech this afternoon. And when they fix, they're kind of like the roofers that we had, who kept putting holes in the roof so they could get more money to fix the holes that they put. And when I figured out what they were doing and said something about it, they sued me to be reimbursed for the cost of fixing the things that they broke. Now, in a logical city, that would be frowned on. But when I raised an issue with the city, I was informed that these were such wonderful guys, they couldn't have done anything wrong. They take us out to lunch every day. Now, in a normal place, that's considered a bribe, but not in El Paso, Texas, because they're wonderful guys. The county attorney, part of his charter is to take care of seniors and things such as this. Roofing fraud has been very bad in El Paso. And they didn't want to get involved because, I mean, golly gee whiz, these are wonderful guys. And, you know, they do so much for so many. And you just clearly are not of the caliber of people that they should have to work with. Poor guys. No matter who I've gone to, all the way up to the governor's office, initially I'll be promised, yeah, we'll go look into it. And then, before you know it, I'm being lectured about how wonderful these roofers are. But I noticed that they're not putting roofs on the houses of state officials or... I mean, state law requires, it's called the local government code. It's actually a state law. And it says they will have liability insurance and they'll post a bond. Well, there were so many people in line to get part of that bond because they routinely screw people, especially disabled veterans. They seem to single out disabled veterans. In Texas, if you're 100% disabled, you don't pay property taxes. And since Texas doesn't have a personal income tax, the government doesn't get any money out of you except in fees. And as one person with the city said to me, if we don't make money off of you, we're not going to spend money on you. Which is an interesting way to look at things. And no matter who you go to, I went to the insurance commissioner. And he said, well, you know, they're right. The law says they have to have the insurance. It doesn't say they have to use the insurance. What's the point of having it? Well, you know, the interesting thing is, excuse me. The interesting thing about this whole scenario is most of what was done by the roofers, if I was a member of the local clique that controls this town, they'd never have done it in the first place. But since I'm a disabled veteran, I'm fair game. In fact, the first words out of the roofer's mouths when they took the contract, how much of that free money that the government gives you can we get? In fact, they knew more about the inner workings of my own insurance company than I did. And when I raised an issue, you'd have thought I'd have suggested shooting the Pope. Well, today's Valentine's Day. Let's change the subject. And interestingly enough, somebody asked me who was Saint Valentine. Why'd they recognize third century Roman saint commemorated in Christianity on February 14th? And from the high Middle Ages, his saint's day has been associated with tradition of courtly love, and he's also the patron saint of epilepsy. Now, it's interesting. You can be the worst SOB in the world, but if the Pope decides that you're a great guy, you can become a saint. Now, St. Valentine was a clergyman, a priest or a bishop, nobody's really sure, and the Roman Empire administered to persecuted Christians. He was martyred and his body buried at a Christian cemetery on the Via Flaminia, close to the Ponte Milvio, to the north of Rome on February 14th, which has been observed as the Feast of St. Valentine, in other words, St. Valentine's Day, since 496 A.D., Now, relics of him were kept in the church in the catacombs of St. Valentino in Rome, which remained an important pilgrim site throughout the Middle Ages until the relics of St. Valentine are transferred to the church of Santa Placida during the pontificate of Nicholas IV. His skull, crowned with flowers, is exhibited in the Basilica of Santa Maria in Cosmedian in Rome. Other relics of his were taken to White Friar Street Carmelite Church in Dublin, Ireland, where they are there to this day. And this particular church is a popular place of pilgrimage, especially on St. Valentine's Day. For St. Valentine of Rome, along with St. Valentine of Terni, abstracts of the acts of the two saints were in nearly every church and monastery of Europe, according to Professor Jack Arbrook of the University of Kansas. Now, St. Valentine is commemorated in the Anglican Communion in the Lutheran churches on February 14th. An Eastern Orthodox Church, he's recognized on July 6th. In addition, the Eastern Orthodox Church observes the feast of Heriomarta Valentine, Bishop of Interamna, on July 30th. 1969, the Roman Catholic Church removed his name from the general Roman calendar, leaving his liturgical celebration to local calendars. Though the use of the pre-1970 liturgical calendar is also authorized under the conditions indicated in the motu proprio, Summorum Pontificum of 2007. Roman Catholic Church continues to recognize him as a saint, listing him as such in the February 14th entry in the Roman Martyrology, and authorizing liturgical veneration of him on February 14th in any place where that day is not devoted to some other celebration. Now, in the earliest list of Roman martyrs, St. Valentine doesn't appear. The earliest list we have access to is Chronography of 354. Although the patron of the Chronography's compilation was a Roman Christian named Valentinius. But it is found in the Martyrologium Hieronymianum, which was compiled between 460 and 544 from earlier local sources. The Feast of St. Valentine's of February 14th was first established in 496 by Pope Galatius I, who included Valentine among those whose names are justly reverenced among men, but whose acts are known only to God. The Catholic Encyclopedia and other hagiographical sources speak of three St. Valentines that appear in connection with February 14th. One was a Roman priest, another the Bishop of Interamna, that's modern Terni, Italy, both buried along the Via Flaminia outside of Rome at different distances from the city. And the third was said to be a saint who suffered on the same day with a number of companions in the Roman province of Africa, of whom nothing else was known. Though the extant accounts of the martyrdoms of the first two listed saints are of a later date and contain legendary elements, a common nucleus of fact underlie the two accounts, and they, in fact, are suspected to possibly refer to a single person. According to the official biography of the Diocese of Terni, Bishop Valentine was born and lived in Interamna. And while on a temporary stay in Rome, he was imprisoned, tortured, and martyred there on February 14, 269. His body was buried in a nearby cemetery, and a few nights later, his disciples retrieved his body and returned him home. The Roman Martyrology, the Catholic Church's official list of recognized saints for February 14th, gives only one Saint Valentine, a martyr who was said to have died on the Via Flaminia. Now, the name Valentine actually is derived from the word valens, which means worthy, strong, and powerful, and was very popular in the late antiquity. About 11 other saints having the name Valentine are commemorated in the Roman Catholic Church. Some Eastern churches at a Western Rite may provide other lists of St. Valentines. The Roman Martyrology lists only seven who died on the days other than February 14th. A priest from Viterbo, November 3rd, Valentine of Pasoa, papal missionary bishop to Redia, among the first bishops of Passau, and later hermit in Zinnoberg, near Maius in southern Trial, Italy, where he died in 475, on January 7th. A 5th century priest and a hermit who died July 4th. A Spanish hermit who died October 25th, 715. Valentine Berrio Ochoa, martyred in 1861 on November 24th. And Valentine Juanzaras Gomez, martyred in 1936 on September 18th. It also lists the Virgin, St. Valentina, who was martyred in 308 in Caesarea in Palestine. Now, the inconsistency in identification of the saint is replicated in the various vitae that are ascribed to him. A common hagiography describes St. Valentine as a priest of Rome or as the former bishop of Terni, an important town of Umbria in central Italy. This particular St. Valentine's, or the priest, was placed under house arrest by Judge Asterius. And during that time, he discussed his faith with the judge. Valentinius, the Latin version of his name, was discussing the validity of Jesus. The judge put Valentinius to the test and brought him to the judge's adopted blind daughter. The judge said if Valentinius succeeded in restoring the girl's sight, Asterius would do whatever he asked. Valentinius, according to the story, prayed to God, laid his hands on her eyes, and the child's vision was restored. Immediately humbled, the judge asked Valentinius what he should do, and Valentinius replied that all the idols around the judge's house should be broken, a judge should fast for 3 days and undergo the Christian sacrament of baptism. Well, the judge obeyed, and as a result, he freed all the Christian inmates under his authority. The judge, his family, and his 44-member household, that's family members and servants, were baptized. Valentinius was later arrested again for continuing to evangelize, was sent to the prefect of Rome, to the Emperor Claudius Gothicus, that's Claudius II. Claudius took a liking to him until Valentinius tried to convince Claudius to embrace Christianity. Claudius refused and condemned Valentinius to death, commanding that he either renounce his faith or he'd be beaten with clubs and beheaded. Well, Valentinius refused, and Claudius' command was executed outside the Flaminian Gate February 14th in the year 269. An embellishment to this account states that before his execution, St. Valentine wrote a note to Asterius' daughter signed "From Your Valentine," which is said to have inspired today's romantic missives. The Legionaria of Jacobus de Varagnine, compiled about 1260 in one of the most read books of the High Middle Ages, gives sufficient details of the saints for each day of the liturgical year to inspire a homily on each occasion. The very brief write-up of St. Valentine states he was executed refusing to deny Christ by the order of the Emperor Claudius in the year 269. Before his head was cut off, according to the story, the Valentine restored sight and hearing to the daughter of his jailer. Jacobus makes a play with the etymology of Valentine as containing valor. A popularly ascribed hagiographical identity appears in the Nuremberg Chronicle of 1493. Alongside a woodcut portrait of Valentine, a text states he was a Roman priest martyred during the reign of Claudius Gothicus. He was arrested and imprisoned upon being caught marrying Christian couples and otherwise aiding Christians who were at that time being persecuted by Claudius in Rome. At that point in time, helping Christians was considered a crime. Claudius took a liking to the prisoner, but when Valentine tried to convert him, he was condemned to death, beaten with clubs and stones, and when that didn't kill him, he was beheaded outside the Flaminian Gate. Now, there are many other legends behind St. Valentine. One is that in the 3rd century A.D., it said that Valentine, who was a priest, defied the order of the Emperor Claudius and secretly performed Christian weddings for couples, allowing the husbands involved to escape conscription. That was conscription meant called up into the military. The legend claims that soldiers were sparse at this time, so this was a big inconvenience to the emperor. The account mentions, in order to remind these men of their vows and God's love, St. Valentine is said to have cut hearts from parchment, giving them to these soldiers and persecuted Christians, which is said to be one origin of the widespread use of hearts on St. Valentine's Day. Another legend is that Valentine refused to sacrifice to the pagan gods. Being imprisoned for this, Valentine gave his testimony in prison and through his prayers healed the jailer's daughter who was suffering from blindness. Now, there are many churches dedicated to St. Valentine in countries such as Italy. St. Valentine was venerated no more than other Christian martyrs and saints. A 5th or 6th century work called Passio Mari el Marthei made up a legend about St. Valentine's Basilica being dedicated to St. Valentine's in Rome. Later, Passio repeated the legend and added the adornment that Pope Julius I had built the ancient basilica on top of his sepulchre in the Via Flaminia. Now, this church was really named after a 4th century tribune by the name of Valentino, who donated the land on which it was built. It hosted the martyrs' relics until the 13th century when they were transferred to Santa Prassede and the ancient basilica was allowed to decay. St. Valentine's Church in Rome, built in 1960 for the needs of the Olympic Village, continues as a modern, well-visited parish church, but it dates back only to 1960. Now, St. Valentine of Rome was martyred February 14th in the year 269. Pope Gelasius I in 496 established the Feast of St. Valentine to be celebrated February 14th in honor of this Christian martyr. Now, February 14th is St. Valentine's Day in the Lutheran calendar of saints, as I said earlier. The Church of England had him in its pre-Reformation calendars and restored his mention as bishop and martyr in its 1661 Book of Common Prayer. In most provinces of the Anglican Communion celebrate his feast. The Roman Catholic Church includes him in its official list of saints, the Roman Martyrology. It's also in the general Roman calendar for celebration as a simple feast until 1955, until Pope Pius XII reduced all such feasts to just a commemoration within another celebration. The 1969 revision of the general Roman calendar removed even this mention, leaving it for inclusion only in local calendars, such as that of Balzan in Malta. His commemoration was still in the 1962 Roman Missal and is thus observed also by those who, in the circumstances indicated in Pope Benedict XVI's 2007 Moto Proprio Summario Pontificum, use that edition. July 6th is the date on which the Eastern Orthodox Church celebrates the Roman Presbyter Valentine. On July 30th, it observes the feast of the Hierom Martyr Valentine, Bishop of Interamna. Members of the Greek Orthodox Church named Valentinos or Valentina may observe their name day on the Western ecclesiastical calendar date of February 14th. English 18th century antiquarians Alban Butler and Francis Dunch, noting the obscurity of St. Valentine's identity, suggested St. Valentine's Day was created as an attempt to supersede the pagan holiday of Lupercalia, which is in mid-February in Rome. Now, it is true that in order to make Catholicism more acceptable, or Christianity more acceptable to the masses, a lot of previously pagan holidays were transferred to the Christian calendar. Christmas, for example, which was said to be the birth of Jesus, was actually established on December 25th, which was the birth date, historically, of Sol Invictus, the sun god. By putting Jesus' birth date on December 25th, the theory was that all celebrations would take place on that day for both the Christianity and pagan sects. And then eventually, Sol Invictus would be phased out. Now, the idea that St. Valentine's Day was created as an attempt to supersede the pagan holiday of Lupercalia has lately been dismissed by academics and researchers. Many of the current legends that characterize St. Valentine were invented in the 14th century in England, notably by Geoffrey Chaucer and his circle, when the feast day of February 14th first became associated with romantic love. Professor Jack Orrick charges that the traditions associated with Valentine's Day, documented in Chaucer's Parliament of Foles, and set in the fictional context of an old tradition, didn't exist before Chaucer's time. He argued that the speculative explanation of sentimental customs posing as historical fact had their origins among 18th century antiquaries, notably Alban Butler, the author of Butler's Lives of Saints, and have been perpetuated even by respectable modern scholars. In the French 14th century manuscript Illumination from Vies des Saints, St. Valentine, Bishop of Terni, oversees the construction of his basilica at Terni. And there's no suggestion in that write-up that the bishop was a patron of lovers. During the Middle Ages, it was widely believed that even birds paired mid-February. This was then associated with the romance of Valentine. And although the legends differ, Valentine's Day was widely recognized as a day for romance and devotion. Now, the flower-crowned alleged skull of St. Valentine was exhibited in the Basilica of St. Maria of Cosmedin in Rome. St. Valentine's remains were deposited in St. Anton's Church in Madrid, where they've been there since the late 1700s. They were present from the Pope to King Carlos IV, who gave them to the Order of the Poor Clerics, regular of the Mother of God of the Pious Schools. Some of these religious orders certainly have long names. The relics have been displayed publicly since 1984 in a foundation open to the public at all times in order to help people in need. Whitefriars Street Carmelite Church in Dublin also houses some relics of St. Valentine's. December 27, 1835, the very Reverend Father Carlo Ordescalli, under the auspices of Pope Gregory XVI, also sent the partial remains of St. Valentine's. The relics and the accompanying letter from Cardinal Odescalchi remained in the church ever since. The remains, which include a small vessel tinged with his blood, were sent as a token of esteem following eloquent sermon. The very Reverend Father John Spratt, Master of Sacred Theology to the Carmelite Order in Dublin, delivered in Rome. On St. Valentine's Day in Ireland, many individuals who seek true love make a Christian pilgrimage to the Shrine of St. Valentine in Whitefriars Street, Carmelite Church in Dublin, which is said to be a place where you can pray to the shrine in the hope of finding romance. Another relic was found in 2003 in Prague in the Church of St. Peter and Paul. A silver reliquary containing a fragment of St. Valentine's skull is found in the parish church of St. Mary's Assumption in Chemno in Poland. Relics are also to be found in Mytilene on the Greek island of Lesbos. Another set of relics can be found in Savona in the Cathedral of St. Maria Assunta. And finally, alleged relics of St. Valentine also lie in the reliquary of Roquemaure Guard in France in the St. Stephen's Cathedral. Also in St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, in Balzan in Malta, also in Blessed John Dunn Scotus Church in the Garbles area of Glasgow, Scotland. And there's the gold reliquary bearing the words Corpus St. Valentine, Body of St. Valentine Martyr, as it translates, at Birmingham Oratory in the UK. You know, I think the relics of St. Valentine is similar to the stories I've heard about pieces of the true cross. If all the pieces of the true cross that had been bandied about were put together, you could build a house. So it's not the validity of the relic that's important. It's the belief people have in the relic that's important. Turning from that, let's talk about something that's the furthest from love and adoration that's associated with St. Valentine's Day. And that's the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Took place in 1929 on February 14th. It was the murder of seven members and associates of the Chicago's North Side Gang. They were gathered at a Lincoln Park garage on the morning of Valentine's Day. They were getting ready to go about their business. They were, as I understand it, getting set to ambush a cargo of illegal alcohol, because that's what they did. Well, four police officers came in with guns and lined everybody there up against the wall and shot them. They were not, it's believed, real policemen. The incident resulted from the struggle to control organized crime in the city during Prohibition between the Irish Northside Gang, headed by George Bugs Moran, and the Italian Southside Rivals, led by Al Capone, or Scarface, as he was called. Now, the assassins have never been conclusively identified, but former members of the Egan's Rats gang working for Capone are suspected of having a significant role, as are members of the Chicago Police Department who allegedly wanted revenge for the killing of a police officer's son by Bugs Moran's Irish mob. Now, it took place at 10:30 in the morning on Thursday, February 14th, 1929. This was a garage at 2122 North Clark Street in the Lincoln Park neighborhood of Chicago's North Side. Seven men who were there getting ready to carry out instructions from Moran were shot by four men using weapons that included two Thompson submachine guns. Now, two of the shooters were dressed as uniformed policemen. The other two wore suits, ties, overcoats, and hats. After the shooting, witnesses saw the fake police leading the men in the suits at gunpoint out of the garage. The victims included five members of George Moran's Northside Gang, Moran's second-in-command and brother-in-law, Albert Kachelik, also known as James Clark, was killed along with Adam Hare, the gang's bookkeeper and business manager. Albert Weishank, who managed several cleaning and dyeing operations for Moran, and gang enforcers Frank Guzenberg and Peter Guzenberg. Two collaborators were also shot, Reinhardt Swimmer, the former optician turned gambler and gang associate, and John May, an occasional mechanic for the Moran gang. Real Chicago police officers arrived at the scene shortly after the shooting and found Frank Guzenberg was still alive. He was taken to the hospital where doctors stabilized him for a short time and police tried to question him. He had 14 bullet wounds. Police asked him who did it and he replied, "No one shot me." He died about 3 hours later. Now, it was widely assumed that Al Capone was responsible for ordering the 1929 St. Valentine's Day Massacre in an attempt to eliminate Bugs Moran, who was head of the Northside Gang. Moran was the last survivor of the Northside gunman. His succession had come about because his similarly aggressive predecessors, Vincent Drucci and Jaime Weiss, had been killed in the violence that followed the murder of the original leader, Dino Banyan. Several factors contributed to the timing of the plan to kill Moran. Earlier that year, Northsider Frank Guzenberg and his brother Peter unsuccessfully attempt to murder Jack McGurn. One more time. The Northside Gang was complicit in the murders of Pasqualino, or Patsy Lollardo, and Antonio the Scourge Lombardo. Both had been presidents of the Union Siciliana, or the local mafia, and close associates of Capone. Moran and Capone had both been vying for control of the lucrative Chicago bootlegging trade. And Moran had also been muscling in on Capone Run Dog Track in the Chicago suburbs, and he had taken over several saloons that were run by Capone, insisting they were in his territory. Remember, in those days, everything within assigned territories belonged to the local chieftain. Now, the plan was to lure Moran to the SMC Cartage Warehouse on North Clark Street on Valentine's Day to kill him and maybe two or three of his lieutenants. It was usually assumed that the Northsiders alerted the garage by the promise of a stolen cutlet shipment of whiskey supplied by Detroit's Purple Gang, which was associated with Capone. Now, I got some stories about the Purple Gang that will absolutely blow your mind, and we're going to be doing those in a later show. The Guzenberg brothers were supposed to drive two empty trucks to Detroit that day to pick up loads of stolen Canadian whiskey. And all the victims were dressed up in their best clothes, with the exception of John May, as was customary for the Northsiders and other gangsters at the time. Most of the Moran gang arrived at the warehouse by about 10:30 that day. But Moran wasn't there, having left his Parkway Hotel apartment late. He and fellow gang member Ted Newberry approached the rear of the warehouse from a side street when they saw a police car approach the building. So they went into a nearby coffee shop to wait and see what was going to happen. They encountered gang member Henry Guzenberg on the street and warned him, so he also turned back. Northside gang member Willie Marks also spotted the police car on his way to the garage, and he darted into a doorway and jotted down the license number before he left. Now, Capone's lookouts likely mistook one of Moran's men for Moran himself, probably Albert Weinsiak. It was the same height and build as Moran. The physical similarity between the two men was enhanced by their dress that morning. Both happened to be wearing the same color overcoats and hats. Witnesses outside the garage saw a Cadillac sedan pull to a stop in front. Four men got out and walked inside, two of them dressed in police uniform. Two fake police officers carried shotguns and entered the rear portion of the garage, where they found members of Moran's gang and collaborators Reinhardt Swimmer and John May, who was fixing one of the trucks. Fake policemen ordered the men to line up against the wall. They signaled to the pair in civilian clothes who had walked in with them. Two of the killers opened up a Thompson submachine gun, one with a 20-round box magazine, the other with a 50-round box. And they were thorough, spraying their victims left and right, even continuing to fire after all seven had hit the floor. Two shotgun blasts afterward obliterated the faces of John May and James Clark, according to the coroner's report. To give the appearance that everything was under control, the men in street clothes came out with their hands up, prodded by the two uniformed policemen. Inside the garage, the only survivors were in the warehouse were May's dog, Highball, and Frank Guzenberg. Valentine's Day massacre set off a public outcry that posed a problem for all mob bosses. Now, within days, Capone got a summons to testify before a police grand jury on charges of federal prohibition violations, but he said he was in too bad health to attend. It's common knowledge that Moran was hijacking Capone's Detroit-based liquor shipments, and police focused their attention on Detroit's predominantly Jewish Purple Gang. Landladies Miss Duty and Miss Ovidson taken in three men as roomers 10 days before the massacre, and their rooming houses are directly across the street from the Clark Street garage. They picked out mug shots of Purple Gang members George Lewis, Eddie Fletcher, Phil Keywell, and his younger brother Harry, but later on, apparently under some pressure, shall we say, their identification wavered. The police questioned and cleared Fletcher, Lewis, and Harry Keywell. Nevertheless, the Keywell brothers, and by extension the Purple Gang, remained ensnared in the massacre case for all time. Many also believed the killers wanted them to believe that the police did it. And the police were corrupt enough in those days. On February 22nd, police were called to the scene of a garage fire on Wood Street, where they found a 1927 Cadillac sedan disassembled and partially burned. And examination showed the killers had used that car. They traced the engine number to a Michigan Avenue dealer who had sold the car to a James Morton from Los Angeles. The garage where the disassembled car was found had been rented by a man calling himself Frank Rogers, who gave his address as 1859 West North Avenue. Now, that was the address of the Circus Cafe operated by Claude Maddox, a former St. Louis gangster with ties to the Capone mob, the Purple Gang, and a St. Louis gang called Egan's Rats. Now, police couldn't turn up any information about people named James Morton or Frank Rogers, but they had a definite lead on one of the killers. Just minutes before the killing, a truck driver named Elmer Lewis had turned a corner a block away from 2122 North Clark and sideswiped a police car. Told police he had stopped immediately and was waved away by the driver, who was in uniform, who was missing a front tooth. Board of Education President Wallace Caldwell witnessed the accident, and he gave the same description of the driver. Police were confident that description fit Fred Burke, a former member of Egan's Rats. Burke and a close companion named James Ray were known to wear police uniforms whenever on a robbery spree. Now, Burke was also a fugitive under indictment for robbery and murder in Ohio. Police also suggested that Joseph Lilordo had been one of the killers because his brother Quescalino's recent murder by the Northside Gang. Well, after a while, police announced they suspected Capone gunman John Scalise and Albert Anselmi, as well as Jack McGurn and Frank Rio, Capone bodyguard, as being the gunman. Police eventually charged McGurn and Scalise with the murder. Capone murdered Scalise and Anselmi and Joseph Hoptoe Giunta in May 1929 after he learned about their plan to kill him. Well, eventually the police dropped the murder charges against Jack McGurn because of a lack of evidence. He was charged with a violation of the Mann Act. Took his girlfriend, Louise Roth, across state lines to marry her. And that violated the Mann Act, technically speaking. Now, the case stagnated till December 14, 1929, when the Barron County, Michigan Sheriff's Department raided the St. Joseph, Michigan bungalow of Frederick Dane, registered owner of a vehicle driven by Fred Killer Burke. Burke had been drinking that night and rear-ended another vehicle, and then he drove off. Patrolman Charles Skelly pursued him, finally forced him off the road. Skelly hopped up on the running board of Burke's car, but he was shot three times by the driver and died of his wounds that night. The car was found wrecked and abandoned just outside St. Joseph, Missouri, and traced to Fred Dane. By this time, police photos confirmed that Dane was, in fact, Fred Burke, wanted by the Chicago police for his participation in the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Police raided Burke's bungalow and found a large trunk containing a bulletproof vest, $320,000 in bonds recently stolen from a Wisconsin bank, two Thompson submachine guns, pistols, two shotguns, and thousands of rounds of ammunition. St. Joseph authorities immediately notified the Chicago police and requested both machine guns be sent to them. They used the new science of forensic ballistics to identify both weapons as those used in the St. Valentine's Day massacre. They also discovered one of them had been used to murder New York mobster Frankie Yale a year and a half before. Unfortunately, no further evidence surfaced in the massacre case. Burke was captured over a year later on a Missouri farm. The case was in strongest in connection to the murder of Officer Skelly. So he was tried in Michigan, subsequently sentenced to life in prison. He died in prison in 1940. January 8, 1935, FBI agents surrounded a Chicago apartment building at 3920 North Pine Grove looking for the remaining members of the Barker Gang. A brief shootout erupted, resulting in the death of bank robber Russell Gibson. Taken into custody were Doc Barker, Byron Bolton, and two women. Now, Bolton was a Navy machine gunner and associate of Egan's Rats. He'd been the valet of Chicago hitman Fred Goetz. He was also privy to many of the Barker Gang's crimes and pinpointed the Florida hideout of Ma Barker and Freddie Barker, both of whom were killed in a shootout with the FBI a week later. Bolton claimed to have taken part in the St. Valentine's Day massacre with Goetz, Fred Burke, and several others. Now, the FBI really had no jurisdiction in a state murder case, so they kept Bolton's revelations confidential until the Chicago American newspaper reported a secondhand version of his confession. The newspaper declared the crime had been solved, despite being stonewalled by J. Edgar Hoover and the Bureau, who didn't want any part of the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Garbled versions of Bolton's story went out on the national media. It was reported that Bolton claimed that the murder of Bugs Moran had been plotted in October or November 1928 at a Corderay, Wisconsin resort owned by Fred Goetz. Present at the meeting were Goetz, Al Capone, Frank Nitti, Fred Burke, Gus Winkler, Louis Compagna, Daniel Cerutella, William Pacelli, and Bolton. The men stayed 2 or 3 weeks hunting and fishing when they weren't planning to murder their enemies. Bolton claimed he and Jimmy Moran were charged with watching the SMC cartage garage and phoning the signal to the killers at the Circus Cafe when Bugs Moran arrived at the meeting. Police had found a letter addressed to Bolton in the lookout nest and possibly a vial of prescription medication. Bolton guessed the actual killers had been Burke, Winkler, Gowitz, Bob Carrion, Raymond Craneneck Nugent, and Claude Maddox. That's four shooters and two getaway drivers. Bolton gave an account of the massacre different from the one generally told by historians. He claimed he saw many plainclothes men exit the Cadillac and go into the garage. Well, this seems to indicate a second car was used by the killers. George Brichette claimed to have seen at least two uniformed men exiting the car in the alley and entering the garage through its rear door. A Peerless Motor Company sedan had been found near a Maywood house owned by Claude Maddox in the days after the massacre. And in one of the pockets was an address book belonging to victim Albert Weinschenk. Bolton said he'd mistaken one of Moran's men to be Moran, after which he telephoned a signal to the Circus Cafe. The killers had expected to kill Moran and two or three of his men, but they were unexpectedly confronted with seven men. Well, instead of figuring out who did what to who, they simply decided to kill all of them and then get out. Bolton claimed Capone was furious with him for his mistake and resulting police pressure and threatened to kill him, only to be talked out of it by Fred Gowitz. His claims are corroborated by Gus Winkler's relative Georgette in an official FBI statement and in her memoirs, which were published in a four-part series in a True Detective magazine during the winter of 1935-1936. She said that her husband and his friends had formed a special crew used by Capone for high-risk jobs. The mob boss was said to have trusted him implicitly and nicknamed him the American Boys. Bolton's statements were backed up by William Drury, a Chicago detective who stayed on the massacre case long after everybody else gave up. Bank robber Alvin Karpis later claimed to have heard secondhand from Ray Nugent about the massacre and that the American Boys were paid a collective salary of $2,000 a week plus bonuses. Karpis also claimed Capone had told him while they were in Alcatraz together that Gowitz had been the actual planner of the massacre. Well, despite Byron Bolton's statements, no action was taken by the FBI. All the men with whom he had named were dead by 1935, with the exception of Burke and Maddox. Bank robber Harvey Bailey complained in his 1973 autobiography he and Fred Burke had been drinking beer in Calumet City, Illinois, at the time of the massacre. And the resulting heat forced them to abandon their bank robbing ventures. Well, historians are still undecided as to whether or not the American Boys committed the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. There many mobsters have been named as part of the St. Valentine's Day hit team. Two prime suspects are Costa Nostra hitmen, John Scalise and Albert Anselmi. In the days after the massacre, Anselmi was heard to brag, "I'm the most powerful man in Chicago." Union Siciliana president Joseph Quinta had recently elevated him to the position of the union's vice president. Nevertheless, Scalise, Anselmi, and Quinta were found dead on a lonely road near Hammond, Indiana, on May 8, 1929. Gangland lore has it that Capone had discovered the pair planning to betray him. Legend states Capone produced a baseball bat at the climax to a dinner party thrown in their honor and beat the trio to death before anybody could do anything to stop him. Well, police tested those two Thompson submachine guns, serial numbers 2347 and 7580, found in Fred Burke's Michigan bungalow, and determined both had been used in the massacre. One had also been used in the murder of Brooklyn mob boss Frankie Yale, which confirmed the New York Police Department's long-held theory that Burke was responsible for Yale's death. Les Farmer, a deputy sheriff in Marion, Illinois, purchased gun number 2347, November 12, 1924. Marion and the surrounding area overrun by the warring bootleg factions of the Shelton Brothers gang and Charlie Berger. Farmer had ties with Egan's Rats, which were based 100 miles away in St. Louis, and the weapon wound up in Burke's possession by 1927. It is possible he used the same gun in Detroit's Mila Flores massacre, March 28, 1927. Chicago sporting goods owner Peter Von Francius sold gun number 7580 to Victor Thompson, also known as Frank V. Thompson, but it wound up with James Bozo Shoopy, small-time hood from Chicago's west side who had ties to various members of Capone's gang. Both guns are still in the possession of the Berrien County, Michigan Sheriff's Department. Well, the garage at 2122 North Clark Street, where the St. Valentine's Day Massacre occurred, was demolished in 1967, and the site's now a parking lot for a nursing home. The bricks to the north wall against which the victims were shot were purchased by a Canadian businessman. And for many years, they were displayed in various crime-related novelty displays. Many of them were later sold individually, and the remainder are now owned by the Mob Museum in Las Vegas. If you've never been to the Mob Museum, you need to go. That is a fascinating place. Well, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre has been portrayed, referenced, or emulated in quite a number of works. In a 1959 movie entitled Al Capone, Seven Against the Wall, a 1959 episode of Playhouse 90, The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, a 1967 film, Capone, a 1975 film, The Untouchables, a 1987 film, The Making of the Mob, Chicago, a 2016 miniseries about Al Capone. Then in the movie Scarface, a 1932 gangster film. Some Like It Hot, a 1959 comedy, directed by Billy Wilder. Oscar, a comedy film directed by John Landis. Sophia Petrillo from the Golden Girls claimed to have been present at the massacre. Mafia III, although only mentioned in a newspaper, Sal Marcano and his brothers slaughtered their former boss and his men. This event was referred to as the All Saints Day Massacre. And Dr. John Becker from Becker references the event by stating, I know it's St. Valentine's Day. I swear, you know, the only person who ever celebrated this day right was Al Capone. Well, you know, Illinois has long been known as a location where quite a number of massacres took place. And on March 25th, 1990, the Happy Land Fire, 87 people died. Now, that actually took place in New York City. And, let's see. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a list of massacres in the United States. I got all kinds of files here, folks. The Guadalupe Canyon Massacre, August 13th, 1881. 5 people. Cowboys ambushed while sleeping. The Election Riot of 1874 in Eufaula, Alabama. Now, that was November 3rd, 1874. 8 people were killed, 70 injured. Chinese Massacre, Los Angeles, California. More than 18 people died. It was October 24th, 1871. The Golden Dragon Massacre in San Francisco, September 4th, 1977. 5 people died, 11 injured. Camp Sumter in Andersonville, Georgia, 1864. According to this, 13,171 people. Elmira Prison in Elmira, New York, 1864. Ludlow Massacre, 1914, Ludlow, Colorado, 19 people killed. The Columbine Mine Massacre in Serene, Colorado. Miners killed with machine guns during a coal mine strike. 6 people died. Ocoee Massacre, November 2nd, 1920, Ocoee, Florida. Rosewood, Florida, the Rosewood Massacre, January 1923. 8 people died. The entire population of African Americans in and near Rosewood, about 350, were forced out of their homes and never returned. The Hanapepi Massacre, September 9th, 1924, Hanapepi, Hawaii. 20 people killed. The Haymarket Affair, May 4th, 1886, Chicago, Illinois. 7 people died. I'm sorry, 11 people died. More than 130 injured. The Heron Massacre, June 21st, 1922, Heron, Illinois. 23 people died. We talked about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. The Brown's Chicken Massacre, January 8, 1993, Palatine, Illinois. 7 people died. Lane Bryant shooting in Tingley Park, Illinois. 5 people died. That's February 2nd, 2008. Aurora, Illinois. February 15, 2019, 6 people died. Spirit Lake Massacre, West Okoboji, Iowa. 35 to 40 people died. And that was March 5th through the 12th, 1857. The Villisca Massacre, June 10th, 1912. 8 people. In fact, I wrote a book, part of a book about the unsolved axe murders of two families in Villisca, Iowa. The Pottawatomie Massacre in Franklin County, Kansas, May 24th and 25th, 1856. 5 people died. The Maristi Cygnus Massacre in Linn County, Kansas. 5 people died. That was 1858. Lawrence Massacre, August 21st, 1863. Douglas County, Kansas. 185 to 200 died, and a quarter of a town burned down. The Wichita Massacre, Wichita, Kansas. 5 people died. That was in 2000. Bloody Monday in Louisville, Kentucky. More than 22 died. August 6, 1855. Colfax Massacre, Colfax, Louisiana. April 13, 1873. 83 to 153 died. Coushatta Massacre, Coushatta, Illinois. August of 1874. 11 to 26 died. The Thibodaux Massacre, Thibodaux, Louisiana. More than 35 died. That was 1887. Could have been as many as 300 killed. They're not sure. Opelousas Massacre, Opelousas, Louisiana, September 1868, more than 300 died. The Boston Massacre, 5 died. That was 1770. Hondsmill Massacre, October 3rd, 1838, Fairview Township in Missouri, 19 died. Well, the list just goes on and on and on. I could probably sit here for another hour talking about the massacres. But we've come to the end of tonight's show. I'll be back tomorrow night when I'll be talking about, Monday. This is Friday. Valentine's Day. If you've got a special someone, you need to go give them a special hug. It's interesting how chance meetings can lead to something more. I met my wife at a dance or a party rather. We both worked for the same company. She was in New Mexico and I was in California, and we both were the top salespeople. We met at the company function and got together the following week. Been together for June will be 30 years. It's interesting to think how that one meeting led to 30 years. All right. Well, I hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. I'll try to make it as interesting as I can. So until Monday night at 6 o'clock Mountain Time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.